You're listening to Casual Wednesdays with Doom Rocket.
That's right. Thank you for listening to Casual Wednesdays with Doom Rocket. I'm Jared Jones, editor-in-chief of DoomRocket.com, and with me, as always, is my associate editor, MJ Kramer. Hi, MJ.
Hi.
And we are very, very humbled and very, very proud to invite our first guest, Eisner Award winner, Mr. Gene Ha. Hi, Gene.
Hi, it's good to be here. They lured me here with bourbon.
Excellent bourbon, though.
Yeah, excellent bourbon. We are sipping on Blanton's bourbon. If you haven't had it, you have not lived. This is some pretty delicious stuff.
Yeah, I'm just going to warn you, if you see these two wandering around with a bottle of bourbon and you follow them, yeah, you're probably going to end up on a very excellent podcast.
And actually, this is the maiden voyage of Casual Wednesdays, of course. This could go either way. Let's see. Do you want to like draw a line on the bottle and see how deep we can get into this thing?
Or
I guess not.
I am such a light drinker.
All right, fair enough. Well, a lot of big things have been happening in Doom Market recently. I hope that you people at home are listening to the Anti-Monitor podcast that you can find on our SoundCloud. And, of course, we just started a new Twitter page.
Yeah, it's the same as our lovely Instagram account, which is at DoomRocket_. We're hoping to be putting out a lot of info on the Twitter account soon.
So make sure that you're following us. That's at DoomRocket_ at Instagram and, of course, Twitter. And then, of course, you can follow Mr. Gene Ha if you're not doing that already. What's that handle on Twitter, Gene?
Oh, my handle on Twitter?
Yes.
It's just at Gene Ha.
At Gene Ha. Simplicity itself. Well, we are here tonight to discuss something that we all love, which is comics. And tonight, Gene has brought us a very wonderful, indelible work. Gene, would you mind telling us a little bit about what you brought tonight?
The book is Nimona, which is the print version of the webcomic by Noel Stevenson, also known as Ginger Haze. And it did a lot of things I did not think were possible. I thought that the golden age of people becoming superstars through webcomics was over, and then Noel Stevenson started up hers as a senior year student at an art school, and it just went crazy viral. I began reading it early on because some webcomic artists I loved it, and it went from kind of a lightweight action comedy strip to something much, much deeper and more complex. I'm still trying to figure out if this is something she had planned all along, or if it's just as her skill grew, she developed into something else, or she just, I don't know. Well, I don't know how she did it. I've never met her or talked to her.
You've never met Noel Stevenson?
No.
That would be obviously the first question I would have if I met her. I'm like, how did you make me cry? Is this an ulterior motive? Was this a comic strip that you wanted to tell? Did you know that ending? There's so many questions that this book elicits. What do you think, MJ?
Oh, it started off very, you know, very lighthearted, funny, goofy. And then it slowly it addresses a lot of social issues. And then it just gets very, very touching and sad towards the end there.
Subtle.
Yeah.
It's really subtle. In the beginning, when I'm reading this book, I'm like, this is a very beautifully illustrated fable. But then like you start to notice different things about it. They're subtle things. But then they occur to you that this is like a part of something different. You're engaging in something different. Like for instance, we're talking about knights and dragons and whatnot, and then there's like a CNN headline news like newscaster on the television.
Yeah.
What the hell is that all about?
Let me also mention, by the way, this is obviously not a spoiler-free podcast.
No.
If you have the chance, go out online and read at least the first chapter for free online. And if you like that, buy the book. And then come back here tomorrow and re-listen to this. Because, it'll be money well spent if you get a copy of the book.
Indeed, absolutely. So why don't we just dive on into this thing and start devouring it? Gene, what were a couple of things that really stuck with you after finishing the experience that is Nimona?
I don't know if I should. I mean, do you want to just immediately start talking about the ending right
Bounce
now?
Bounce all over the place. Whatever you feel most comfortable.
Okay, I'm gonna. I just want to go over a few things that, in a way, for me, this is the ideal book for showing the principle of us that Scott McCloud talks about.
Mm-hmm.
where a simpler, more cartoony face is more approachable. She draws in this very simple style, and it looks like it's very childlike doodles. When she draws a profile of a face, it's pretty much a blockhead with a triangle nose on the side.
Mm.
It looks like how she's trying to copy how a child would draw, even though if you look at the cover of the book later, you can tell she actually has a lot of skill. Yeah, she has some realistic chops if she wants to use them. But this is a conscious choice not to make things realistic, not to use... There's very little realistic perspective in the book in the backgrounds. Well, it's kept very abstract.
Wouldn't you say that also the fact that it was a webcomic and had to come out with a certain semblance of continuity or regularity, I should say, that maybe Stevenson possibly streamlined her aesthetic a bit to make it easier to kick out?
I think so. And the thing is, you know, but again, I don't know what the process was and how she made these decisions and stuff like that. I can't figure it out. I mean, I assume that everything was done as a conscious choice, but you never can tell with these things.
And that's the thing, though. I totally get what you say. It's a streamlined, rather simplistic approach, but at the same time, it's so detail-oriented.
Yeah.
It's those little nuances that you pick up when you're reading the book, things that you don't count on, but mm-hmm. then they catch up with you later on during a read. Like Nimona's hair changes subtly throughout the entire book. You may not notice it immediately. Like, her hair's purple all of a sudden. And then all of a sudden, she's got, like, this proto-tank girl thing going on.
A little
like,
mohawk. Yeah, but, so cute.
But the one thing that I guess I took away from it is that as her hair changes, she's becoming a little less, you know, attached to this artifice that she may or may not be carrying. That maybe that as her situation becomes more dire,
yeah.
her shape-shifting capabilities change too. That's just a little detail that Stevenson either yeah. put in there deliberately or something else.
Well, okay. Early on, it's established that she's a shapeshifter. So that kind of, you know, that's part of the explanation for why the character's look changes over time. But, yeah, it's amazing how everything holds together so beautifully in the long run, where it's one of those things where I can look at all the details of what she did early on, look at it later, and it doesn't feel like she's rewriting things or backtracking or... It all, like, it's like a season of The Wire. Every piece fits together in the end. Every piece. It's amazing. I'm going to say that there's a lot of television shows that people absolutely adore and that there's things about them I love, but I have trouble handling them because the pieces don't fit together and they pretend they do and they don't. So
no, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I can name a couple of shows right off the top of my head, actually.
Yeah, I had to stop watching Battlestar Galactica because they had the episode where the imaginary Cylon Super Babe suddenly appears in physical form to Balthazar. Balthazar is that name?
You got me, man.
Okay. Anyway, yeah. And that he all this time he's been this imaginary his imaginary friend, and then she shows up in the flesh, and he starts acting as if no one else can see her, and then everyone else can see her. So he's confused, and then at the end of the episode, she magically disappears off the ship, off the Battlestar, and they don't explain how it happens. And I thought, okay, this is either something really brilliant or something where they came up with a clever idea and they're not going to explain it. So I had to stop watching and ask my friends, okay, so how did the Super Babe get off the ship?
Just like that.
And they said, is this explained in later episodes? And they said, nope, never explained. And
that's it.
Yeah, at that point it's like, okay, I don't think I can invest more time in this show. I have to stop. There's no problem like that in Nimona.
No, there's not.
Amazing things happen. Things that look like they won't make sense later. And it all fits together. It's a beautifully written book. And I don't know how a fourth-year college student was able to do that. It's one of those things like teenage Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein. There are legitimate reasons to doubt that anyone at that age should be able to write a book like Frankenstein. But it happens. Works. Yeah. It's a beautiful book.
One thing that really strikes me with Nimona is that, like, on top of it just being really well-written, it's well-crafted as well. I mean, like, there are archetypes and tropes that Stevenson employs in her narrative, but she does it in this like strange, surreal, slightly modern way. It's a comic book.
It's a very modern way, but she uses the trappings of some high fantasy things and smooshes them together with a lot of modern things, which is very, very cool. Mm-hmm. Blackheart himself, he's a very modern villain. He's in the fact that he's not really a villain at all. He's much more of an anti-hero.
I had a tough time with Blackheart initially because, let's just segue into this from Stevenson's narrative approach to her characterization. Blackheart is not a villain. He's not. He's painted as a villain in this book by the villagers that surround him and by the circumstances that he found himself in. But the man, at his heart, realizes that the end does justify the means. And he does go about some dirtier, underhanded ways to go about them. But Nimona feeds into that, like taps into that evil that he doesn't necessarily have. So when I'm reading Blackheart and I'm trying to be like, well, you're not the bad dude that she thought you were.
No, just to recap a few things here. The basic premise of the book is that there is a supervillain, a mad scientist inside of a high-tech medieval kingdom, ruled by a king, run by a bureaucracy of scientists. And he's the evil scientist who's trying to overthrow the system. And then a teenage girl comes to his door and says, I'm your new sidekick.
Like it or not.
Yeah, like it or not. And when he finds out, she's really annoying to him, but when he finds out that she's a shapeshifter, he says, that can be useful, I'll let you stay. And chaos ensues.
Chaos does ensue, but also a relationship slowly takes root.
Yeah.
And in some of the most unlikely ways. I drew some parallels in my mind when I was reading it.
I was just going to say also, so Jared was talking earlier about the fact that Blackheart is not a villain. And the thing is, he's a person who chose the role of a villain.
Right.
But in his heart, he's not evil, but he is a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And he's chosen the role of a criminal and a supervillain mastermind as the way he's going to make change in life.
With a very strict moral code, though. He doesn't want to kill people. He just kind of wants to make mischief, pretty much.
Well, he wants to figure out a way to destabilize the government.
But until Nimona comes along, he's not a really...
He doesn't have the focus.
Yeah.
Like the
really isn't
the conviction to actually see his mission through. He wants to do it more than anything, and he has great cause to do it, but Nimona's the catalyst.
Here's the thing. I think eventually he would have figured out a way to do it.
Of course. But that would have been a far less interesting book, I think.
Yeah, it would have been subtle, and he with his moral code, would have kept things away. The reason Nimona is attracted to him is because she would really, really like to be evil and have a friend who's evil. So she's trying to push him to become this friend that he's not become the evil friend that she really wants, and he's not evil enough for her.
No. But that's an interesting thing, and it was a thought that had occurred to me when I was reading this, like the parallel that I had in my mind, was that this relationship is not dissimilar to that of V and Evie of V for Vendetta. It's like there's a level of Stockholm Syndrome that took place in that book that doesn't exist in here. Nimona arrives with agency, and she arrives with a vendetta.
Well,
and
that more took place in the movie than in the book.
Yeah. Oh, there's some.
There's some of both. But I think the point remains is that Nimona, as a character, isn't so much a person in a story, but a force of nature. And quite literally at certain points in the book. If she doesn't react in a certain way, then the story could have divulged into like a different like subplot or something. There's serious cause and effect that occurs throughout this book. That's the thing I love most about it, is that these chapters, which are broken up because they're assigned on the website, were actually placed together and read so seamlessly as a book. It's like, because Nimona did this, Blackheart now does this. Or because Blackheart saw her like this, he now feels this way. And these chart a course and create like these really cataclysmic moments for these characters that elicit real emotional depth.
Yeah.
That's not what I was counting on when I was reading this book. It floored me.
I like the comparison with V for Vendetta because it brought up something I didn't really think about, which is that there actually is some Stockholm Syndrome here, but it's actually the complete reverse of V for Vendetta, where V essentially is the one being slowly drawn into the web of, oh, I can push my moral boundaries a little further, and I can sympathize with this person who I shouldn't, who is a vicious, murderous, sociopath terrorist. And he's getting drawn in by her, and she's kind of taking command of the situation. You know, Nimona is the horrible person holding the hostages and killing people. So yeah,
I think another thing is that if this were in the hands of a lesser creator, they would have probably tried to hype up the sexuality, the twist of like the gender tropes. It's like it was the female that made it happen, but in reality, in this book, it doesn't matter. Like as a matter of fact, there is no overt masculinity to be subverted in this book. It's person meets another person and they accomplish something together until they can't anymore. It's a lot more complicated as a story because of it, but it actually resonates more in real life because that's what it is. People approach each other, their lives get affected in one way or another for good or bad, and then they either stay together or part ways. And it's always a painful experience. And that's something that I think the Mona captures really quite well. I mean, because you, this has been on your radar for quite a bit now.
Yeah.
You introduced this book to us when we were talking about this podcast. I'm really sorry that I didn't know about this before, but here we are. How did you feel about the critical responses? We were talking about this earlier. How do you like how the world took Nimona, or didn't?
Okay, well, obviously the fan response and frankly, kids online just really, really fell in love with this book. Mm-hmm. The numbers on it were just like gigantic and huge. She became a superstar. I feel like the comics community isn't taking this book seriously yet, though, because it's so from out of left field. It's not something that frankly should exist probability wise. There's just the odds of something like this happening today are incredibly. I mean, it's incredibly low. There's been nothing like it for like 8 years or something like that. Out of webcomics. You know, the last time something this important has happened in webcomics was things like Penny Arcade or things like that. You know, Jeff Jacques and questionable content.
It's a tough racket, the least.
Yeah, titles like this that affect people as web, you know, webcomics like this do not come along very often.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think it was possible because I thought the market was too flooded with all of the webcomics out there. There are so many out there.
Sure.
And there are some great ones out there that are just dying because it's free comics.
Yeah.
How are you going to compete? How's your free comic going to compete with somebody else's?
Precisely right.
She had to be so insanely talented to get anyone's attention at this point.
And then ultimately, the book's out. It's consumed by the readership. Then it nails. Did it nail an Eisner Award? A nomination?
It got a nomination. Yeah, I don't think it won an award. No. So, that night, I think.
Well, Miss Stevenson took home a lot of Eisners for Lumberjanes.
Lumberjanes. But Nimona, of course, gets ignored. Now, when you talk about the comics community as in general accepting Nimona, are you talking about in terms of an essential piece?
Well, I say comics community, what I mean specifically are the hardcore, kind of mostly Wednesday Warrior type people who spend a lot of time writing and talking talking about comics online. And the casual people, mostly people who make up the fans for Nimona, are not people who spend most of their time talking, buying, discussing, debating, getting angry about comics.
Of course.
It's something they do on the side for enjoyment. Kind of like what we used to do when we were kids.
Oh, man.
Having this be one volume makes it a lot more, easily consumable for that kind of culture.
How long did it take you to read it?
A few days. And that was because I was putting lots and lots of time into reading other comics as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a fast read. It's a very fast read, especially once you get like about halfway through. It just starts going and going.
Well, it grips you.
Yeah, the drama gets churned up.
I'll say that this is something I always appreciate. It's a book you can read multiple times and get different layers.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helps. I hate a comic book that you read it once and it's kind of like, I never need to open that one again.
Yep, that's done. Nimona is one of these books that when I was a kid, I used to like to call rain books, which is weird. But like whenever it would rain, I would just grab a stack of books and go to the nearest window and read because it was the soothing thing to me. And some of the best stuff I ever read was listening to the rain. That's why I listen to the rain, by the way, MJ. I have this. There's a great website somewhere. I'll put the link on the attached to this to the embed code. But Nimona is one of these books that I could read again and again because it is so rich, but it's also comforting in a way. It's a very richly detailed story that doesn't waste your time with trite details. Every single piece of this book is essential. Everything about the relationship between Golden Loin, a name that I love, by the way, and
Ambrosius Golden Loin.
Mm-hmm, and Blackheart. I think that's a relationship that is handled with such complexity and subtlety. It's such a downplayed part of the story, and yet it adds so much more to it once you think back on it. When you realize the consequences of these two men meeting each other in battle, meeting each other in adversity, and then realize what's really going on there. Subtextually, this book is one of the most heartbreaking romances I have ever read. It's tough. It's a tough read.
Yeah. I'm going to bring up something which is kind of my conspiracy theory read on it.
What do you mean?
It's a thing where it's probably not what's going on, but it's what I thought was going on until, like, there's a few pages added inside the graphic novel that were not in the original comic strip. So the ones, there's a scene at the end where it shows very young Nimona long before the story started, in a village dealing with a totally different government.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was not in the original.
Really?
Yeah. And unless I totally missed it somehow, because I've reread this comic a few times online. But I'm fascinated by the fact that apparently her true form is a giant, unique dragon.
Yeah.
See, I wasn't sure about whether or not they were saying that she is that same dragon, or if she's like one of that species, or if she was one of that species that got tested on in that lab and everything. So
the straight reading of it from the whole graphic novel is that she's a unique being who can reproduce, or not reproduce, can regenerate like a phoenix by part of her breaking off, and then the old portion will die no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So there can only be one of her at a time.
Yeah.
Well, there can be two at a time, but one of them's going to die, and then after that there'll only be one.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of creates a new phoenix-like being with slightly different personality. But I was kind of curious about the fact that Blackheart is a guy who experiments and makes mutant dragons. And before I read that section, I thought, wait a minute, is she actually one of his mutant dragon experiments that wandered off on its own and then came back because she wanted to hang out with her father?
Now that would be something.
Yeah, but apparently that's not it. But here's the other weird thing then. She still is a giant mutant dragon, apparently, that he did not make. But then she goes in the lab, and the first thing she does in the first panels is look at the mutant dragons he's growing.
Mm-hmm. She thinks it's great. Yeah, right there. That's interesting.
And she thinks it's great. She doesn't think, oh my God, you're a monster. You're a person experimenting on these animals like, the way I was experimenting on. I need to kill you too.
Yeah.
She thinks, oh, that's great how you're doing it. She respects how he's doing it.
Well, then that obviously adds depth to like what she is. Me and MJ were talking about this earlier today. Because there's that one bit in the middle of the book where Blackheart's talking to that scientist woman, and she regales him with this tale of
Glorith's beast.
Yeah, yes. Where this knight takes on this giant beast, mm-hmm. who can shapeshift, and instead of being slain, which is how the legend goes, people speak in whispers that the beast actually slew the knight and took her form, mm-hmm. and has been walking this plane of existence ever since, adapting to different various forms and things like that. And there is evidence that would support that being Nimona herself. Chief of which is when she's finally captured by the corporation and this awful woman is doing experiments on her. And she finally goes, okay, they took her blood. And she goes, you wanted a monster? You got it. And the blood takes the form of this dragon, a detached form of Nimona, a kind of a form of Nimona without her id. Let's say, her in a purest form.
Yeah, it's essentially the scientist has forced the phoenix rebirth to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the two have, just by taking a blood sample, the blood sample is another split off. And one of the two parts is going to die, one's going to live.
Sure. One thing that I find really fascinating is that there are so many ways to interpret what Nimona is because it's never explicitly said.
Yeah, I think Stevenson does a really great job of keeping that ambiguous and mm-hmm. letting you make up your own mind about it.
That's the creepy part. Like when we were going through the book together, remember that bit where maybe the dragon took the form of the knight and it shows a really creepy image of the knight with mm-hmm. like sinister eyes?
Yeah.
That's spooky to me. Mm-hmm. Like that kind of like suppositional like quality of a story, that's the kind of stuff that gets under my skin. It stays there.
It's like a maybe this happened. Maybe this super creepy thing happened to occur.
Like I that kind of stuff keeps me up at night. It creeps the hell out of me. So, with Nimona, and of course, how wonderful it is, have you ever thought to yourself to maybe contact Noelle Stevenson and thank her for such a wonderful book and maybe get to the heart of some of these answers? Because you could probably have a better shot than we would.
The thing is, I'm not going to seek her out and try to do that. She's massively successful at this point,
mm-hmm.
Especially for a young webcomic artist. She's getting a lot of projects, and I'm just going to be one of various people just saying, hey, you're great. And mm-hmm. I don't really want anything from her other than more stories.
Sure.
So there's not a, there's not a useful reason for me to try to contact her beyond just saying, hey, you're stuck. Beyond saying, meet one of my people and say, your work is cool.
I would just want to, I would just like be one of these like lost fans who like hectors Damon Lindelof on the street. Like, hey, what the hell's with the deal with the island? Did it exist or what? What's going on? I would be like one of those dorks. I wouldn't hound her, of course, but like there are things in here I have to know. Like they're just gonna gnaw away at me forever, unless I have some sort of like absolute definitive answer one way or the other.
Yeah. See, this is one of those principles where the fact that there are unknowables is what makes the work good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the big example I always use is that the first Star Wars movies left huge amounts of ambiguity about what happened in the past, mm-hmm. what things were. They didn't try to explain everything or show everything. You never had a giant scene of people debating in the Galactic Senate. They just mentioned that it happened.
Some long monologue about what the Clone Wars actually was.
Yeah. You didn't find that interesting?
Well, the thing is, okay, those movies left room for the viewer to imagine stuff and to create worlds in their own head.
Yeah. And we had long enough to do that. And then they made those prequels and they just...
So I guess what we're saying is...
Explain everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't need a prequel to Nimona, I suppose, then.
Yeah, if you explain everything, you're going to kill it. And the other thing is I'm going to say that the art is a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And art gives... The nice thing about art, the reason why, for instance, scientists love science fiction is because it gives you intellectual tools that you can apply, you can use in ways that the creator did not imagine. And therefore, ambiguities... A story or a piece of artwork is more useful if you leave things ambiguous so other people can find new uses for it. If you design it so it's only used for one thing, it's a bit like having a blender that's only good for beating eggs but isn't good for making cake batter.
Sure. Yeah.
Or, you know, a screwdriver that can only work on one piece of furniture.
It's such an interesting thing to me because I was talking to Matt Birdie, the producer of Anti-Monitor, host of that as well. He was trying to get at me about why I'm so hard on a lot of superhero comics these days. And I was trying to explain to him that like a lot of the magic is gone. He's like, what are you talking about? It's all about magic or superpowers or something. I'm like, yeah, literally about that. But like subtextually, it's about nothing. It's the pulp equivalent of two kids smashing action figures together. And there's a lot of demystifying of these icons. But when I approach a book like Nimona, and it just kind of like makes me reassess how I approach a graphic novel or a comic book. Yeah. I feel so grateful for it.
Well, okay. Let me say that the reason I think that you and, for instance, somebody with a similar point of view on that, Alan Moore, are disenchanted with current comics is because they're comic books about being superheroes and about the superhero universe. They're not... There's a certain level... Again, as a tool for, like, changing how you see the world, it doesn't really do anything. I don't know where this quote is. If you know what it is, go to my website and contact me. But it goes along the lines of the job of art is to make the magical seem every day and the everyday seem magical.
Mm.
And therefore, you have to... A successful piece of art changes how you see the world. And a comic book that's only about... You know, a superhero comic book that's only about a superhero universe and that doesn't change... You know, doesn't feel like it relates at all to your life doesn't change how you see the real world. A good piece of art changes how you see the world, and it doesn't do that for you anymore. When you were a kid and you read certain comic books, I'm sure it changed how you saw what it was like to be, say, a seventh grader or something like that.
Certainly did.
It changed what it felt like to live inside of a town. You grew up in Michigan?
Yeah.
Yeah. It changed what Michigan looked like to you. It did that when I was a kid growing up in the 70s and 80s, and I walked through downtown South Bend after having read comic books set in downtown areas and alleyways. It's like, oh, alleyways are cool. I was just fascinated with alleyways. It was just like the coolest thing.
You would half imagine Daredevil jumping down from a fire escape and then leaping away.
I imagined like where the superhero, I'd look at an alley and I just think of the superhero fights that could happen there and where the action would happen, what you would do with that dumpster and blah, blah, blah. I've talked a lot about how I love Matt Wagner's Mage, and he did a lot of stuff where it was essentially totally people in normal street clothes, one guy who's a King Arthur type with a glowing green magic baseball bat that is Excalibur.
Yeah.
And the people looked like people who were actually my friends. Older, but my friends. And it changed how I looked at them. It changed how I looked at the town I lived in, because it kind of looked like the rundown town that Mage was set in. And it just changed how I saw the world and the possibilities of the world. That's what good art does. and a book that's about what it's like to be a celebrity superhero who runs a billion-dollar corporation does not change how I see the world anymore. Yeah. Those ideas have been played with for decades, and it's a comic book that's about exploring the Marvel Universe more deeply or the DC Universe more deeply. It's not interesting to me if that's all it is. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say Grant Morrison's work, for instance, a guy I know you like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. It's got so much subtext and different ways of reading it and stuff like that. That is still interesting to me.
When you can subvert concepts that are so recognizable, you can make them interesting. I'm absolutely in agreement with you.
Yeah.
It's heartening to see a creator like Noel Stevenson working today, because it reminds me that there are innovative, creative people like yourself that apply their worldview and their approach to the medium in such a thoughtful way. And it makes those books awesome and exciting to look forward to.
Yeah, and even though she's essentially doing a book about an evil mad scientist and a fake teenager shape-shifting immortal beast,
mm-hmm.
the relationship between the teenager and the adult mentor getting subverted still feels so much like real relationships I know between, older folks and younger folks, sure. trying to deal with each other and yeah. having conflicts and learning from each other in both directions. It really, really works.
Yeah. And it's nice to see that kind of a relationship. How oftentimes you'd have that, you have a little bit of a sexual subtext.
Mm-hmm.
And Batman and Robin?
just anywhere with like the younger female mentor and the older, the older male mentor and the younger female protege. I'm really glad that they avoided that in always in this.
Yeah.
Because that's...
Doesn't strike me as...
Done a bit much.
Especially when you consider the kind of relationship Blackheart has with himself, let alone other people. Getting in on a friendly level, let alone a sexual level, is probably damn near impossible. I mean, the guy's pretty single-minded. Knows what the world is, at least from his experience. One of my favorite parts of the book is when him and Golden Loin are having their second act battle right after that interview sequence, and he knocks Blackheart knocks Golden Loin to the ground, and he says, "I should cut your arm off just to show you how it feels." And he says, "You wouldn't do it." And he's like, "You're right, I wouldn't. And I'm the villain. So what's that say about you?" Like, here's a guy whose worldview has been rocked to his very core, and yet he can still contextualize every single deed that he does, up to and including having a relationship with a small woman who wants nothing more than just to be a sidekick.
And convince him to be more evil.
And to be more evil. Yeah.
And to murder a lot of people.
And to murder a lot of people. That's one of the more jarring things about the book, I think, is that Nimona is so bloodthirsty, and it actually lends credence to this conspiracy theory that she's actually this malevolent dragon.
But let's talk about tropes. It's a nice switch up, making the little tiny girl be the one's like, "Come on, let's kill him."
Yeah, no, I love it.
Fun.
I love how she calls him boss.
Yeah, it's great.
Like, there's something really fantastic about it, and the way that she because she does all her own lettering too. The way she draws, just letters boss. Those four letters next to each other in succession somehow make me want to laugh out loud. It's so adorable, and at the same time, It's almost kind of spooky, because she's so eager to enter into a world that we don't know she already knows. We just assume that she's this kid who says, "He lives on a castle and he hurts people. I want to hurt him too." It just takes every concept that you approach this book with and it knocks it on the ground. Is there anything else that you want to add to this, Gene?
Okay, let me just flip through the book really quickly.
Go for it.
Such a gorgeous book.
Yeah. The little epilogues at the end, were those published on
Oh, actually, web yeah, cover? Those were new.
There's the epilogue, and then there's a couple little bits at the end.
Okay, the two Christmas scenes were part of the website.
Were they? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. The epilogue things, the main epilogue.
The epilogue
thing,
was so sweet.
Yeah, I didn't even read the Christmas thing. What Christmas thing?
Oh, it comes after the thank you pages.
What?
Yeah, the first one is obviously non-canon.
Oh.
But the second one, I think, is canon.
How did I miss this?
You didn't.
I saw the thank you page, and I was like, well, that's it. I didn't bother to keep going. And even check out the sketches in the back. That's how bad a reader I am.
Well, we own the book. You can go back and look at it later. Right.
Yeah, so if you're taking your advice and reading this book, or have read it already, hopefully, yeah, don't miss those sections. It's like the credit sections out of a Marvel movie.
Yeah, or the stinger.
Yeah, or like a special feature in a Criterion collection.
Oh, I'm going to bring up, Molly, the thing you brought about, the fact that it did not sexualize the relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone loves The Professional.
Yeah.
But good Lord, what a creepy movie.
Yeah, what a creepy movie. We can go into a whole conversation after this is done about how I feel about Luc Besson and where the direction of those movies go, but it's like being friends with somebody who reads Red Hood and the Outlaws. It's the same thing. It's like, oh, I like Luc Besson movies. I'm like, why? Just why? But that's totally beside the point.
He does do some things well. I mean, there's a certain point in my 20s when I had to stop watching French movies.
Yeah.
Because everyone I saw was about a male lead who's the same age as the director having an affair with a young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, okay, I really can't deal with this same fantasy over and over again from different French directors. This is just really driving me a little crazy.
Yeah.
It was also pretty great that Noelle draws Nimona like a normal looking girl.
Oh yeah, she's chunky.
Yeah, just like, yeah, she's short, she's stocky, she's like, she wears normalish clothes.
Mm-hmm.
She's just
normalish medieval clothes.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Which is funny because there are some characters in here that are wearing completely modern clothes.
Yeah, it's really
funny.
It's
super great. But yeah, Nimona just looks like a normal girl, acts like a normal girl, other than the turning into, you know, big monsters and killing people. But yeah, I love her look. It's really
it's a distinctive body type. It's a distinctive hairstyle. MJ was threatening that she was gonna cut her hair with the sideburns and the flip in front.
No, I was gonna do the hawk like at the end, her little mohawk at the end.
Well, I mean, yeah, go for it.
And I'm gonna say I know a lot of kids, boys and girls, who, given that kind of power, would probably end up a lot like Nimona.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have known people who are a lot like Nimona, very gung-ho about life, want to, like, just take the block of cheese and take a huge big bite out of it. You know, they want to feel the juices of the orange drizzle down their chin. They just want to have so much...
And kill some people.
Maybe not kill people, but, like, you know...
They do want to destroy the system.
Yeah, they want to subvert concepts of, like, what a personality can be. I lived with a woman once. She had a trihawk. And everywhere we went, people just stared at us. And I thought it was so great. I was like, this is every day for you, isn't it? And she's like, every day, every minute. And I was like, and I loved the way she said that. Like, she just was so fearless. And that's who Nimona reminded me of a little bit, was this roommate I used to have. Because she's so plucky and she's just so, like, eager. Like, look at her gripping that gun. She's like, I'll show you how to use this thing, you know? And she's standing right next to this guy who looks the part of some sort of evil supervillain, and yet he's not. Everything about this book is fantastic. Is there anything else you wanted to add, Gene?
I think that's about it. By the way, also, we've been also drinking Blanton's. We have not been paid yet, Blanton's Capital Corporation, for this endorsement, but it's surprisingly sweet bourbon, but it's also not unpleasant. It's not sickeningly sweet. It's got these wonderful smoky qualities to it that work beautifully with it. It doesn't have, like, the liquor. Oh, God. I'm going to just mention, like, Jack Daniel's is the other sweet bourbon I can think of. And I loathe it. It's one of my least favorite liquors in the world.
Well, Jack Daniel's is not a bourbon.
It's, what is it?
It's a Tennessee, I think, sour mash whiskey.
Okay, but yeah, it's kind of the super sweet thing that...
Turn me off of that. Maker's is a sweet Tennessee bourbon, right?
Also not a bourbon.
Okay.
It's not?
No.
I thought Maker's was bourbon.
Nope.
Okay. But yeah, it's... This stuff is beautiful, and they got it was a gift for my birthday from MJ and from Jared, and it's so crazy delicious.
It is damn good.
It's so smooth.
Yeah,
it's nice.
I used to work at a really nice, pricey wine bar. We used to just have it around. I used to take it for granted how easy it was just to reach for it. And then we moved to Chicago. You can't find it anywhere. And then Gene says, "Can't find this whiskey." I'm like, "Oh, the hell, I can't." So there it is.
Yeah, so Blanton's, you know, we are looking for a new, or they're looking for a new sponsor for their podcast, so, you know, just in case.
They can pay us some bourbon.
They can pay us some bourbon, that'd be great. Well, that is going to be it for our first installment for Casual Wednesdays with Doom Rocket. I, of course, would love to thank Mr. Gene Ha for taking a moment to participate in this tomfoolery.
It's always a pleasure hanging out with you guys.
Oh, what a sweet
It's great to see you.
Great to see you, Gene. And, of course, I'd like to thank my lovely co-host, associate editor MJ Kramer of DoomRocket.com. Please don't hesitate to follow her on Twitter. That handle, please.
At MollyJane_K.
And I'm at JaredJones_. And of course, at Gene Ha. Please follow us also at DoomRocket_. And we'll see you in the funny pages.